Samuel 18 is where we are at. Took a quick little trip last week on another road, but this one should be a whole lot of fun as we march down. David has been, if you remember, kicked out of power. He has been removed. He's been chased out of town, and he was chased out of town by the heir apparent, young man by the name of Absalom. If anyone can please tell me the most striking feature of Absalom, you get a gold star in your crown. Yes, his hair, his beautiful long locks, his Fabio hair. And he was also described as one of the most handsome gentlemen in the world. I'm pretty certain that having hair and being handsome do not correlate at all. Absalom has taken over, and he's burned a lot of bridges. I was thinking about it, I didn't do it, but writing down all the sins of Absalom. Absalom is terrible. He has done so many terrible things that you wonder how in the world there could be any redemption with this guy. And here, as you can see on the heading of 2 Samuel 18, he's going to die. And is that funny? He's going to die. This chapter, he's going to die. And let's dive into it and see what happens. David mustered the men who were with him and appointed over them commanders of thousands, commanders of hundreds. David sent the troops out, a third under the command of Joab. Remember, he's the main guy that's been in charge of the army and will remain that way as long as David is in power. So Joab, and then a third under Joab's brother Abishai. And he's one of the sons of Zeruiah, and a third under Ittai the Gittite. If you remember him, he was the foreigner that showed up the day before David was chased out of town. And David says, look, Ittai the Gittite, you don't need to follow me. I'm going somewhere that you really don't need to go. Don't follow me. And Ittai says, no, I'm following you because you're the rightful king. And so David ends up putting him in charge of a third of the army. And the king told the troops, I myself will surely march out with you. But the men said, you must not go out. If we're forced to flee, they won't care about us. Even if half of us die, they won't care. But you are worth 10,000 of us. There's a text note. You can read it if you want. What's written there is probably correct. It's what makes the most sense in the passage. The other manuscripts, it says, for now there are 10,000 like us. Doesn't really make much sense of why that would be a thing for David to stay back. So I believe what we got here in the text up there is correct. They're essentially saying, look, you're so valuable. If you die, we're toast. If you die, everyone scatters. If you die, the battle's over. So we need to protect you. Yeah, Lynn. Oh, and David, his tens of thousands. Yeah. Yeah, and that's how valuable he is. He's valuable like the 10,000s. And the hard part now is David. I think there's also another reason why they're trying to keep David at home. And he's getting older, and he's not as fleet-footed as he used to be. And there could be a major problem if he goes out into battle and gets behind enemy lines. That's the reason why, remember the advice of Hushai and Ahithophel were contradictory. And Hushai made it sound like David was this strong warrior, and if you back him in the corner, he'll kill you. And everyone by this time probably knows, David ain't that tough anymore. He's tough, to be certain. I'm sure he could do a lot of damage. But that's the reason why Ahithophel's advice was so brilliant. Look, let's just chase after him now, take him down while he's weak, and we'll get rid of him. And should have followed that advice. But here he's got the chance to muster an army, and the army looks at him and says, look, David, you ain't going out with us. You stay back. We'll protect you. We'll go out and fight the battle. It would be better now for you to give us support from the city. The king answered, I'll do whatever seems best to you. So the king stood beside the gate while all of the men marched out in units of hundreds and of thousands. The king commanded, Joab, Abishai, and Ittai, be gentle with the young man Absalom for my sake. And all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders. So it's strictly spoken out, please be careful when it comes to Absalom. Don't hurt him. Please treat him gently. Give him safety. Give him passage. And he didn't just say that as you hear it. He says it to his three commanders. But to make sure that it's not one of those, hey, I'm going to give you this order, please pass it on to the rest of your troops, he actually then says it to the troops as well, saying, please, no one touch this kid. That's how much David truly loves Absalom, even though, if you think of all of the horrible things Absalom did, Absalom deserves none of this mercy. Absalom would kill David in a heartbeat, but David does not wish to see Absalom harmed in this whole endeavor. That's his wish. So, and all the troops heard the king giving orders concerning Absalom to each of the commanders. The army marched into the field to fight Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. I'd love to have pictures of the forest of Ephraim. The problem is we have no idea where this forest is located. There is nothing nowadays that resembles anything that's being described here. I mean, it's not to say it didn't exist. Times have obviously changed. But we have no idea of what this forest looked like. Verse 7, there the army of Israel was defeated by David's men, and the casualties that day were great, 20,000 men. You got to remember, this is a civil war. All 20,000 men that died were all Israelites. Why, whether they followed David or were following Absalom, it was their own brothers and uncles and cousins that they were killing. Verse 8, I got a question mark on this. It was very fascinating listening to people talk about verse 8. The battle spread out over the whole countryside, and the forest claimed more lives that day than the sword. What does that mean? If you have a little NIV text note or a study note, I think it's garbage, but we should read it anyway because someone smarter than me put it in there. What does it mean to have the forest claiming more lives than the sword? Yeah, is it Narnia? That's kind of what you get the idea, or the what? Oh, yeah, Lord of the Rings is what I was going for. Yeah, you start thinking, man, maybe these trees got up and... That would be fantastic. Alex. Yeah, well, they ran into trees. Yeah, it's really fascinating. Does anyone have the text note? Do you have the NIV Study Bible? What do you have there? Oh, you have something? Yeah, I love that. Many men got lives. We'll come back to this. Is that what yours said too? No, what does yours say? Yeah. These are two fantastic attempts at explaining it that I just don't buy. One is this, they got lost. Is the forest really that big? Because we're talking about 20,000 people died, and if we're going to do the math, that means 10,001 had to have died by the forest. You're telling me that 10,000 people entered this forest and 10,000 people got lost? Yeah, you think to yourself, it wouldn't be that. I'd be like, Dave! Yeah, he would probably be running from me. But it can't be that expanded. Now, I guess maybe, again, we don't know what the forest of Ephraim looks like. So I guess that's a possibility. I just don't buy it. And the same thing with this. The terrain was rugged. I read another commentary that said that David's men were specialized in guerrilla-type warfare, and thus were better trained to handle this. And I'm like, where are you making stuff up now? Where did that come from? It literally, one guy in one commentary said it, and all these people started quoting him. I'm like, I can make stuff up too. Yeah, the Rouses got him. I think that's exactly what happened. The rodents of unusual size. Yes. See, now that one's really... See, the bears... Now, this one was cool because I didn't put up any things because it was a little freaky looking. But some guy... Have you ever heard of the Brick Testament? I know Jason has. I think he was the one that turned me on to it. The Brick Testament. Some dude went through a lot of major stories, both old and new, and recreated the stories with Legos. And it is awesome. Like the one, I was going through some of it, and it had when it said the 10 concubines were left in the palace. So it has these 10 girls, and they're holding a note. It says, all he says is just take care of the palace. And you're like, this is crazy. And some of the weirdest stuff. But sure enough, on this one, on the caption that says the forest claimed more lives, there's all these bears and these little red Lego bricks all around showing all the blood that's been spilled. And all these bears are eating. That's possible. I mean, we do have an example from that where in the book of 1 Kings chapter 17, we have Elisha is walking around and these kids come up and start teasing him and saying, go on up, you bald head. And Mike and I would get really offended at things like that. And so Elisha calls down a curse, and two she-bears come out of the woods and maul 42 of the kids, which is why you don't badmouth your parents and old people, right? And so there's an example of bears coming on God's command and doing that. It's pretty interesting. So I lean towards that. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, God can make hailstones come out of nowhere. He can do whatever he wants. I wouldn't be surprised some dude's running and all of a sudden this tree just whoomp, just swings around, whack, and knocks him. I would love to. I think it's more Narnia. Again, if you have problem with supernatural miracles like that, you probably have a problem with the greatest miracle of a man coming back from the dead. That usually doesn't happen either. So I'm open to stuff like that. Now, is that the way it was? I don't know, because that's all it says, and there is no further explanation. In fact, the writer of this doesn't even care that much about the battle, because right after this verse, boom, we move it back into the story of Absalom and what happened to him. And it really doesn't matter. But I think it's kind of cool to think that a forest would come alive and just start, you know. Wouldn't that be cool if, like moss, when moss attacks, wouldn't that be cool? Like, you just walk along this patch of moss, jumps at your face, and goes down your... this is stuff I think of. It keeps me up late at night, so... I know you're feeling very sorry for me right now, but, yeah. Yeah, you feel sorry for Heather, too. Absolutely. So now to Absalom. Now, Absalom happened to meet David's men. He was riding his mule. It doesn't sound very manly and valiant, and but that's how it was. So a mule stronger than a donkey, a good to. And again, this was the whole reason why Hushai's advice was so brilliant. Remember that Hushai's advice was, King Absalom, you should go into battle too. Where Ahithophel's like, dude, you don't need to go into battle. David's men are like, David, you don't need to go into battle. We'll take care of this. But Absalom, with his pride, is in this battle, riding his mule and sure-footed mule in the forest of Ephraim. Yeah, and what it is you get the idea that Absalom is not there in a fighting capacity. He's riding a mule. If you're there in a fighting capacity, you would be there on a horse. But this is one where he's riding around almost in victory. That's what these people would do. So he shouldn't be out there. He shouldn't. Yes. Yeah, I guess he could be fleeing. Yeah, because all it says is that he happened to meet David's man. He very well could be taking off at this point. Well, it's tough to tell. It's tough to tell. So he's riding, and then the mule went under the thick branches of a large oak, and Absalom's head got caught in the tree. Now, it does say head, and I double-checked it, and it does say head. 98% of commentators, I just make up statistics, by the way, most commentators all agree that it's a synecdoche, right? Isn't that right, English people? That which is of the whole, you can say a part, is meaning for the whole. Like if you're playing soccer and it hits you right here, what do you call that? It's a handsball. Yeah, even though it hits your arm. Yeah, it's not just his head. The reason why is because of its hair. And that's the reason why they think that the hair was mentioned early on. Because also, how do you get your... I guess it's possible. How do you get your head stuck? I mean, that would be brutal. You're Did you just not see it? You're like, I'm going. Turn around. You know, and it gets them like, I think it's the hair thing, and that's why they say head. It just means hair. Yeah. Maybe that's why the forest claimed so many lives. Did David's men just duck? Or were they shorter? Misshaped heads. That's why we made it through. Survival of the fittest right there, baby. It's beautiful. Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah, maybe he was looking at a girl. Is that what you're... Oh, a free mule wash. Yeah, hopefully not that. All right, so his hair gets caught in the tree. He was left hanging in midair. The original Hebrew is a little more poetic. The original Hebrew says that he was caught between heaven and earth. Is it... Oh, is that what he says? Yeah? Does New King James say that too? Yeah, it's very poetic, and he was caught between heaven and earth. And the mule leaves. And this is true that if you think about it, it's kind of symbolic of what's actually happening to poor Absalom. Is he really isn't, he doesn't really belong anywhere. He's really not the king, though he is the king. And his mule, his kingly status symbol, has now left, and Absalom is got nothing. It's kind of the symbol in this picture. Yeah, and the mule... Well, that's the thing. That's the reason why we don't think he wasn't there in a warrior mentality. Yeah, because if it was me, get the sword out, I wouldn't cut the hair. I'd try to cut the branch first or something. But you get the thing that he's stuck. And where's all his friends? They're lost. Okay, no, I don't know where they're at. The trees are stabbing him or something. I don't know what's going on here. Yeah, Absalom is... And this is what was predicted was going to happen. This was his punishment, was the kingdom was going to be taken away from him. This is an awesome story. When one of the men saw this, he told Joab, I just saw Absalom hanging in an oak tree. I mean, wouldn't that be a great conversation? You're like, you're walking along, you're like, oh, be right back. Hold on a second. You go find Joab. Joab, found Absalom. He's hanging in an oak tree. And Joab's response, Joab said to the man who had told him, what? You saw him? Why didn't you strike him to the ground right there? Then I would have had to give you 10 shekels of silver and a warrior's belt. Essentially, that even though Joab was told specifically, don't touch the kid, Joab privately pulled his guys aside and said, I'll give you 10 shekels of silver and a big giant belt if you kill the guy. And so he's saying, why didn't you do this? You would have had this reward. But the man replied, even if 1,000 shekels were weighed out in my hands, I wouldn't lift a hand against the king's son. In our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai protect the young man Absalom for my sake. And if I had put my life in jeopardy, and nothing is hidden from the king, you would have kept your distance from me. In other words, if I would have done it, I would have come back and said, but Joab gave the order, and Joab would have been like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. And he would have thrown him under the chariot. Yeah, it would have been horrible. I love Joab's response. Because Joab denies none of the claims. In his silence, he actually confirms, yeah, I think that's right, about right. Yeah, I think I would have ditched you and left you to fend for yourself. Joab said, I'm not going to wait like this for you. So he took 3 javelins in his hand and plunged them into Absalom's heart while Absalom was still alive in the oak tree. So he's hanging there. No, Joab comes up with 3 javelins and starts stabbing him. Well, because it's a little more fun to stab him while he's hanging in the midair is what I'm guessing. Yeah, if you cut him loose, he might run. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah. Which, he's still alive. He's dangling, and he's got 3 javelins now in his body, and he's still alive, by the way, just so you know. Because it says right after that, and 10 of Joab's armor bearers surrounded Absalom, struck him, and killed him. So after it was all done, it was a true pinata party with Mr. Absalom. And some people made a big deal about there was 10 because of the 10 concubines left behind. That's a little stretch if you ask me. Maybe there were the 10 guys. It was the 10 wives of the 10 guys. I don't know. Here we go. Okay, should we take a look at some pictures here? I went online and downloaded some pictures here. What do you think? Yeah, it's not that clear. Yeah, that's a horse. Yeah, that. That's a mule? I don't know ears. Horses' ears go up. Yeah. I don't know. I didn't think the mules got that big. Can mules get big? Oh, they do? Well, then, I'm sorry. This is the stuff I don't know. So that's a pretty cool little picture. How about this one right here? That's okay. It's kind of cool. Does Absalom look handsome to you? And his hair doesn't look very luxurious. I don't know. I do like this one. This one's cool. But he's got a sword, again, which doesn't make any sense whatsoever. If you got a sword, dude, you'd be chopping away. What was that? That's the thing. You would imagine that he would, but I come to the conclusion that he didn't have a sword. Because if he was too vain to cut his hair, I would have started chopping the tree. Unless this was one of those bam-bam things, like he's riding, it gets caught, and Joab's men come upon him right then. That could be... That's a little darker. Yeah, at least the forest is a little bit thicker, I think, so... Oh, you want me to go back? He's not wearing it. He's got a loincloth. That would be tough riding. I don't know. I don't know how this is just some guy's hang on. There we go. Is that a mule? Okay. The ears. See, now I've learned something. Okay. So now we get to I did find a couple of cartoons. So I thought these were kind of cool. It's like all kinds of wrong. I know. I understand. Yeah. What are you going to do? Yeah, it's more than that. Yeah, it's actually... Actually, there. And then... Wow, Absalom, and I thought that I was having a bad hair day. I thought that was kind of cool. Let me finish up the story, because this end part is really interesting. Verse 16, then Joab sounded the trumpet, and the troops stopped pursuing Israel, for Joab halted them. They took Absalom, threw him into a big pit in the forest, and piled up large heaps of rocks over him. Meanwhile, all the Israelites fled to their homes. When they sounded the trumpet, that essentially meant, we won. We've got Absalom, he's been taken care of. And one of the Old Testament requirements is anyone that hangs on a tree is cursed by God. And so what you do with those people, the requirement was you would not let them go overnight hanging that way. You would pull them down and toss them into a pit and then throw a bunch of rocks on them, and that would be the burial they have. And then this really strange kind of epilogue. During his lifetime, Absalom had taken a pillar and erected it in the king's valley as a monument to himself. For he thought, I have no son to carry on the memory of my name. He named the pillar Absalom. He named the pillar after himself, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Kind of an interesting thing. Apparently, there is a pillar there in that area called Absalom's Pillar, but everyone agrees that it's not original, that someone built that up as kind of like a little tourist destination. But it really does beg the question, and that is, what legacy do we want to leave? If we were going to leave something, this seems to be a very popular thing nowadays. People wanting to know what's going to live on beyond me. We're focused on that. We're drawn to that in some strange way. There's something about wanting to continue on in memories of people. And I haven't been able to find a way to really make it holy. Even Heather and I have done this at our alma mater, Concordia University, Irvine. We bought a brick. Go to the brick, and I only bought one because I was cheap. It says Mark and Heather Manning, because we were married by then, class of 1994. And it's still there to this day. And every time I go there, guess what I do? I look for my little brick, and I walk over like, there's my brick. Look at that. And I'm sure everyone else that's walking by is like, why is this dude staring at the ground? And it gets trampled on, you know, hundreds of times a day. Oh, do you? Yeah. The tons of Disneyland ones as well. What can we do here in this life that actually truly does last? Only things that the Lord will remember. The only thing that's going to last is eternal life, whether that's in heaven or hell. That's the only thing that lasts. If you truly do want to make a legacy, then having others come to faith is the only way to make a lasting legacy. You could become the greatest person nowadays and be honored, but I'm telling you, maybe 10 years from now, 50 years from now, 100 years, definitely 1,000 years from now, no one's going to care. There are only a few select people in history that will actually be remembered continually in history. We've got the Bible as a great record of all the things that have been done in history. But nothing that you and I can do, whether it's setting up a will or a trust or funding children's hospitals or things like that, none of that ultimately lasts. It's not to say that it's bad. Please don't get me wrong. But I know that a lot of people want to leave a legacy. If there is a legacy that you could leave, there is only one legacy that there is that will last forever. And that's bringing people into a saving faith of Jesus Christ. That will last. And I don't know, I don't think it's going to be like the Ray Bolt song, though the Ray Bolt song is really cool, and it gives you kind of a cool idea. It's called Thank You, and Ray Bolt, he dies and he goes to heaven, and he's there, and people start coming up and talking to him, and you know, the first one that comes up says, this little boy, and he says, hey, I was a kid in a third world country, and you gave some money to a missionary, and he came and brought me the good news of Jesus Christ, and I'm in heaven today because of your money that you gave, so thank you. And then another person comes up and says, you taught my third grade Sunday school class every single week, and every week you talk to me about Jesus. And I'm here today because of that ministry, so thank you. I don't know, I don't think we're going to get to heaven and we're all going to sit around and congratulate each other and stuff like that. But it definitely does show that the lasting legacies, not the Absalom monuments, those aren't going to last. They eventually crumble and die. The real ones are what we do in terms of the faith of other people. Let's keep going. Now, Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, said, let me run and take the news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of the enemies. Remember Ahimaaz, he was the well kid. He was one of the people that was hiding out in the well, remember? And some people had seen him, and so he hid, and then they went through the hole in the wall and were able to go and tell David, hey, you better run for your life. This isn't looking good. So Ahimaaz, I guess he likes to run or something like that. He says, let me go and deliver this to him. You're not the one to take the news today, Joab told him. You may take the news another time, but you must not do so today because the king's son is dead. So just so we're all clear, does Ahimaaz know that Absalom is dead? Just said it, right? Okay, we're clear on that? Okay, comes into play in a little bit. Then Joab
Oh, by the way, why do you think Joab's telling him that?
Right.
Oh yeah. I mean, it did happen one time earlier when a guy said, "Hey, I saw Saul. He was dying. He asked me to kill him, so I killed him." Yeah. Here's the story. Yeah. And David's like, "You're a dead man." And boom, off he goes. I mean, that's not to say that that's David's total reaction every time, but I'm guessing that what Joab is saying, Ahimaaz, you're a good man. And I'm not going to send you with the message that the king's son is dead. Though there's great jubilation. I mean, the skirmish, the battle for the kingship is now over. We've won. But everyone seems to know that the number one thing on David's mind is what's going to happen with Absalom. So I think that's exactly why he tells him. No one can understand why Ahimaaz wants to do this. There is no good. Even Joab says later on, there's no benefit. So verse 21, then Joab said to a Cushite, guy doesn't even have a name. Wouldn't you like that? You're the foreigner. I think David might kill the messenger. You, come here. Come take this. I'd be like, no, wait. I'd be like, sure, I'll give him the message that way. All right, sounds good. And I'd go off a totally different way. We don't even know who this Cushite is. All we do know is that he is not a fast runner. Just telling him. Go tell the king what you have seen. The Cushite bowed down before Joab and ran off. Ahimaaz, son of Zadok, again said to Joab, come what may, please let me run behind the Cushite. But Joab replied, my son, that's the reason why we think that he's looking out for him, because you wouldn't call him my son. That's a term of endearment. My son, why do you want to go? You don't have any news that will bring you a reward. He said, come what may, I want to run. You get the feeling like the dad's like, fine. So, go. So Joab said, run. Get out of here. Then Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and outran the Cushite. While David was sitting between the inner and outer gates, the watchman went up on the roof of the gateway by the wall. As he looked out, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out to the king and reported it. The king said, if he is alone, he must have good news. No one knows why he says that. I guess we can maybe deduce if he saw hundreds of people running towards the gate, that they're probably being pursued, maybe. But King David says, if he's alone, he must have good news. And the man came closer and closer. Then the watchman saw another man running, and he called down to the gatekeeper, look, another man running alone. The king said, you must be bringing good news too. So I think David maybe have some wishful thinking. I don't know. Maybe that's what happened in those days. The watchman said, it seems to me that the first one runs like Ahimaaz, son of Zadok. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Did he like run like a girl or something? Maybe he was a really quick runner. Maybe he danced like Elaine, you know, and had those, he's running down the, I don't know. I'm not too sure. But it is true. You could tell people, budget. I could probably spot you from behind just by the way you walk. It's just, you know, the way it is. He's running in a certain way. So Ahimaaz is he's a good man, the king said. He comes with good news. So he's a good man, so he's bringing good news? Yeah, I think, again, that's why I think this wishful thinking, but yeah. Ahimaaz called out to the king, all is well. He bowed down before the king with his face to the ground and said, praise be to the Lord your God. He has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king. The king asked, is the young man Absalom saved? I mean, first question out of the dude's mouth. He wants to know, how is Absalom? Ahimaaz answered, and I think there was a pause, by the way, I think this is where Ahimaaz finally figured out, oh, that's why I probably shouldn't be the one telling him this. Because he goes, I saw great confusion just as Joab was about to send the king's servant and me, your servant, but I don't know what it was. Now, we did establish earlier, right, that Ahimaaz knew that he actually was told that. So I think Ahimaaz is like, I don't know, actually, king. It's all this confusion. There's this, it's like a party. There's a pinata swinging around. I don't know what happened.
did. I'm not too sure what took place. I think he just saved his backside. Oh, there we go. The king said, stand aside and wait here. So, thanks for the good news, but you are no help to me. So he stepped aside and stood there. Then the Cushite arrived and said, my lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has delivered you today from all who rose up against you. And David's like, I already know that. The king asked the Cushite, is the young man Absalom safe? The Cushite replied, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up to harm you be like that young man. Essentially saying, yeah, he's dead. Saying it in the most polite way possible. The king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. It is one of these kind of heart-wrenching moments in Scripture as this father grieves for his son. And so my question for you is, what do you think of David's reaction? It's upside down in a sense. Why is that? Yeah, a whole bunch of people just went out, and just so you know, the story's going to continue right along that vein where Joab's going to come and say, look, all these people just risked their life, and what are you doing? Yeah, and that might be part of the thing. David might be struggling with being kind to those who are very unkind to him. Someone was about to say something over here. Exactly. How would you like that? He knew that one of the reasons why Absalom had to die was because of his sin with Bathsheba. And I don't think we can prove the numbers, but someone did throw it out there. I was intrigued by it, but the numbers don't match up. But one of the things, again, if you steal something from someone else, you've got to pay it back 7 times, right? And someone pontificated that 7 of David's kids eventually died. Now, again, they didn't list which kids, and maybe this is, you know, Absalom's just one of many. But, and it is true, some of David's kids do die in this whole thing. Yeah. Yeah, it does. Carol. I think that's a huge part of it. Because remember early on after the sin with Bathsheba and the kid that was born and the kid died, right after the kid's dead, he goes, all right, I'm good. And he gets up and they're like, dude, why are you okay? And he goes, well, I'm going to see him again in no uncertain terms. Is he going to see Absalom again? And that might be, I don't know if anyone has ever lost a loved one who does not know God. That should be a huge thing. It should be.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be honest, because I was really frustrated listening to pastors preach this particular part. It got to the point I had to start turning them off, because what they said just blew my mind. One pastor actually didn't come out and say it, but he applauded another pastor who came out and said, he shouldn't be sad at all. What an idiot. Why is he grieving over this rebellious, nasty, sin-filled son? And if you're grieving over kids like that, something's wrong with you. And I'm like, whoa. And I started thinking about that more. Because I know there's part of us that we cringe at this concept. We cringe at the idea that David is weeping over a son who is evil and nasty and rebellious and sin-filled. And we cry out against it. We're like, that's horrible. That's wrong. You should be happy. You should be wanting that justice. And we shouldn't. Because the question then becomes, for us, what about us? What do we think about a father who doesn't wait for us to get our act together, but in the midst of our rebellion, in the midst of our sin, in the midst of us wanting our father dead, while we were still yet sinners? That's when Christ died. Yeah. And I wonder if that's part of it, saying how terrible I feel that this is now the end of the matter. The game is now over. Yeah. No pastor said what we're saying right now. Every pastor I listened to took the tack of, if someone dies in your life, eventually you just got to get over it. I was in shock. I'm like, does anyone see that here David is actually saying, you know what, I would rather die in his place. And I'm like, there was someone who died in my place, who didn't wait for me to get my life together. There was someone that grieved over the stuff I was doing, even when I didn't care about it. Even when I was completely against him. Like the prodigal son going up and saying, I wish you were dead, give me my money. And yet there is God standing on the porch, looking out, saying, is he coming back? Will he come back? And I'm sure people thought of that father too. What an idiot. The son stabbed you in the back. He went and wasted your money. Everything is now gone. He doesn't care squat one about you. And you have that kind of love for him? And that is exactly the message Jesus is trying to convey. That's exactly why I was there. And there is no short of coincidences and correlations between David and God. Not to say it's a one-to-one, not to say that it's perfect, but I'm telling you, I think what David is doing is grieving over his son because he knows he's not going to get another chance. And that's what fathers do, even with wayward, rebellious children like you and like me. And in a spiritual sense, aren't we glad that God doesn't look at those who die in rebellion and say, oh, thank God they're gone. I'm finally rid of them. Anytime someone comes to faith in Jesus Christ, it says that the angels rejoice and celebrate. It doesn't say it in the Scriptures, but I think we could probably make a case that anytime someone dies without Jesus Christ, God is terribly, terribly grieved. That's how much God loves the unlovable. And it's I know that that's why the pastors did it. I understand there's this sense of justice in us that we want to see Absalom punished for the garbage he pulled. But that's not what God sees. God sees a lost child. God wants to see us all come back to Him. That was a challenge for me to reorient my brain to make sure that my heart is beating with God's heart, not that I'm changing God into my image, but that I am being remade in God's image. Let's pray. Lord, thank you. And what a challenge this is for us to really have this, because Lord, you know how I felt, and I know that so many other people felt it too, of wanting to see Absalom get everything he deserved. You just cry out for that justice and that revenge. But Lord, when you see someone die without you, it is a tragic death. And I pray that we would all, right now, at this moment, reaffirm our faith and commitment to you. That we would reaffirm that we are your children. And even if we've been wayward, and even if we've been rebellious, you still stand on that porch and wait. You still stand in between the gates wanting to know, are we safe? Are we okay? And when we return, you rejoice. And celebration ensues. But if we don't return, I believe you are much like King David, who weeps and mourns. Lord, I don't understand this love. It is so beyond my capacity, but that is you. You are so much higher and greater and more wonderful than anything I am. Thank you for your truly amazing love. And may I be remade every day more into that likeness and into that image. In Jesus' name. Communion is all set.